everybody. Welcome to Terror Talk.
Welcome to Terror Talk.
Yay.
What if I just repeated everything you said through the episode?
I imagine people would absolutely tune out quicker than they may already do so.
But what if I said it better?
Then I would just stop talking and then you would stop talking. And then nothing would happen.
But then what if? Just kidding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Today on the show, we're going to talk about Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, very famous movie from 1962 based on a novel. This stars Betty Davis and Joan Crawford as Jane and Blanche Hudson. And this movie is so interesting. Before I tell you what the movie's about, you know, a lot of you might have heard of it, but maybe never watched it or seen scenes from it or clips from it. But I think we both really do recommend that you watch it. Mm-hmm. It's a great example of the creation of the psycho biddy subgenre back in the day. I think it's...
That's a great way to say that.
It's long touted as like the movie that started it. I did want to tell you that at the time that this movie was made, Joan and Betty were fading as stars. They were sort of hitting that age that women would hit where... they were no longer desirable for movies. They were either the ingenue, the mother, or the crone in movies. And so they were falling out of favor, so much so that it was originally slated to be shot at Warner Brothers. But, and I looked this up because I recognized one of the sets, and I'm like, mm-hmm. I know that studio. And
I've been there.
Yeah, exactly. I've been there. We used to go there for lunch all the time. It's right across from Paramount Pictures. But they were... shooting on Warner Brothers, and because these two stars were sort of seen as has-beens, the production was moved over to what was then called Producer's Studio, and it's now called Independent. It's an independent studio called Raleigh Studios on Bronson, right across from Paramount currently. The WB was going to go do some, I think, Gypsy the Musical or something, because that was like where all the hot stars were. So they weren't expecting a ton, and... it turned out to be this movie that, you know, both actresses got nominated. They didn't win, but for the Academy Awards, and the whole picture did win some Academy Awards. But and then it was, you know, cult classic and all of this, and it really set up a whole subgenre of horror that we now know. And I just wanted to throw that out there because
it's relevant.
Yeah, it's totally like the relevant. Culture of the time, right?
Right, and I think how it's evolved over time and the way that we now just view women's roles in film, and they also, you know, both of these actors came from different backgrounds and different styles, and we know that Bette Davis was like heavy in theater, and how it's evolved over time and watching it, I think in some ways we have more discussions about it today than even when it did happen, just because of how we view women and also women in relationship to like mental illness and things like that. So
yeah, the reviews of it now, like people watching it now as a classic, I think I'm sure it gets more play now than it did then. Of course,
yeah, there's more commentary, I think.
Yeah. And we also have the media, of course. We also have the technology to have stuff like this be very, very available. And we don't have to watch just the movies that the production companies push towards us. You know, you see the ones that get all of the ad budget, but we also have all this streaming and everything, so we can see all these kinds of movies more so than they would have been able to then. Mm-hmm. So it's a domestic thriller, a suburban horror. And I wanted to mention also that if you haven't watched the Ryan Murphy series Feud, which season one came out in 2017, and it's about Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. And another thing you might want to know is that these two have a long history, these two actresses have a long history of hating each other. And then they do this movie. And I think part of that was very apparent on screen, but it was also part of what made it work. And there's a book about it that you can read. And there's also this series that's basically like a docudrama of what happened between mm-hmm. them that Ryan Murphy did. For those of you who are Ryan Murphy fans, it's pretty good. And they're about to do a season. There's a season two coming out here in January nice. That doesn't have anything to do with Betty and Joan, but it's like another famous feud type of thing that he did. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
That's cool.
But so here's what the movie's about. Jane Hudson, who is played by Betty Davis, is an aging child star left to care for her wheelchair-bound sister, Blanche, also a former child actress, but then developed into a grown-up actress, whereas her sister Jane, Betty Davis, or Baby Jane, kind of just stopped being super famous and popular when she was a kid and did some movies, but only because her this sister of hers kind of brought her along and gave her some jobs. So ultimately, Blanche becomes wheelchair bound, and that's one of the plot points that you don't really figure out to the end what happened or how she became that way. So they're stuck living together in this mansion in Old Hollywood. And Blanche plots to get even with Jane for the car crash that left her crippled years before, but Jane is desperate to keep Blanche imprisoned as she plans a new rise to fame, and it's all very delusional, but she's very mentally ill, as you will see when we talk about her. But she tries to hide Blanche from the doctors, and we'll get into the psychology of this and all of the things that she does, and we'll sort of diagnose the character and all of that. But first, we're going to do a little thing that we like to call
Baby Facts with Belle. I couldn't fit in whatever happened to Baby Jane Facts.
No, it's just Baby Facts.
Baby Facts.
Which is weird, but sure.
It is weird. It's totally weird. Okay. Based in, Shannon was just talking about this. A known rivalry between Joan Crawford and Betty Davis created tension on the set. Betty Davis had this installed on the set to anger Joan Crawford, who was on the board of this item's competitor.
Okay.
They really did some shit to each other.
I know. It made the movie so authentic.
I know. I think of some of those scenes, too, that were so intimate between them and what they must have been. Talk about method.
Amazing.
Number two, what song does Baby Jane sing in the opening act?
Okay.
Number three, according to Betty Davis, in her book, This and That, the original film was going to be shot in color. Betty opposed this for what reason?
Gotcha.
Number four, how many films did Joan Crawford appear in throughout her career?
Wow. I bet that would be an interesting number.
And then lastly, number five, what was Betty Davis an advocate for? Like one of the things she was most known to advocate
Murder.
For. She may have advocated for a lot of things, but this is something that she was known for.
Okay. So at the end of the show, some of you may not have ever heard the horror facts because you only listen to the true crime episodes, and this is in the true crime of the week's slot because we're talking about female psychopathy. So if you don't know, we do these questions, these trivia questions, and then at the end of the show, Kathy gives us the answers, and I try to guess, and I very rarely get them right. That's how that goes.
I forgive you.
I feel forgiven. So how was this, you watching this time for you?
So I had seen it in parts.
Okay. So this was your first sort of sit down.
First time, like, actually sitting down and watching the whole thing all together.
Amazing.
It's not the feel-good movie of the year for sure, but I do think that it is an incredible film. It's an incredibly sad story. The performances are amazing. And I think it's one of the earlier films that demonstrates female psychopathy or narcissism or sociopathy. We'll get more into the mental health piece of it. And it's just, it's one of the first of its time, I think. So overall, like, this is not a movie that I would watch a million times, but the acting, the storyline, their chemistry, it was for its time, I think it was pretty remarkable.
Agreed. I sat down and watched this movie all the way through for the first time during COVID.
Okay.
I had, like you, seen bits and pieces of it. During the COVID lockdown, I would always kind of do like a palate cleanser, lots of horror movies and stuff like after work. And on the weekends, I got a lot of movies watched because I couldn't go anywhere or do anything. And I watched a lot of older movies and this was one of them. And I thought, God, this is so nutty. Like it's so psychological, and the performances are so good. And it's 2 hours and 15 minutes long.
It's a long film.
It's a long film because it really does, like, the very first scenes in it are all about when they were kids. So you get the full picture of that. And then you get a little bit, and then there are these neighbor characters that are set up, and there's a cleaning person or a housemaid's character that gets set up. And then there's, you know, this guy that comes in to help baby Jane in her delusion, play piano for her as if she's going to become a star again. There's that character. And there's this very long chunk of time in this movie. I would say a good hour and a half of it is really just watching these two women kind of torture each other. It starts out with them torturing each other because the ultimate victim in this, Joan Crawford's character, isn't great either in the beginning. Like, no. You can see how they're kind of assholes to each other. And then baby Jane becomes more and more and more of the aggressor because of her delusions, etc. And so then it becomes very lopsided where, you know, Joan Crawford's character is very much a victim of her circumstances and is being held and abused and all of that. But it starts out kind of even. And then, so it's like a really long, like, there are so many times when Blanche tries to get out.
Yeah.
And you're all of the tension, you know, it really is a thriller.
It is. And it's also a mental health film. Because you look at the beginning of the movie where I think it's the father who really sets them up to compete with one another. And you start to see that rivalry from early on and how that develops later in their life. And I think it's only because of Blanche's circumstances that she doesn't become just as evil, to be perfectly honest. And in a way she is, she's just more of the inverted one, right? The more victimized one.
Yeah. And I don't want to ruin certain plot points for folks because I do feel like this movie may not have been watched in its entirety by a lot of our audience. So I really do encourage you to go out and watch it. But you find out certain things in the end that have happened in the past that you make assumptions about throughout the whole movie. And then it ends up being slightly different. I want to talk a little bit about maybe both psychology, but it's more that Bette Davis's character of Baby Jane in the title gets very flushed out and mentally ill throughout the whole thing. So I guess I'll just throw out one of the first things I notice in the movie that gives you an understanding of where it's going to go. You can obviously see that Baby Jane is bitter and annoyed. Like, that in the beginning is really clear that she doesn't like her life, but you can make a lot of assumptions for why that might be. And I know Kathy has an article too to share that will reference some of the psychological aspects of this. But the first thing I notice Baby Jane doing is she mocks her sister.
Yeah.
That's the very first indication I got in this movie, even though I know what's going to happen, of the behavior that is contempt. She's got definitely aggressive, you know, facial gestures and the way she mocks her, where, you know, Blanche will say something like, "How was your day today?" And Baby Jane will say, "How was your day today?" That's what I mean by mocking. That's really the first thing. And you start to go, oh, she's an asshole.
Yeah, she's a dick.
Yeah.
I'm going to pick it up from there. You and I have talked about personality disorders and the development of them on this show a multitude of times. And I think that when I was watching this, to your point, Shannon, you have this little kid who, to the outside world, it looks like she's, you know, being spoiled and has all of these things and she's a child star and all of this attention. But we know that the development of narcissism and some of these other disorders can also come from like an overindulgence of things. Mm-hmm. And in the absence of that role, they're met with rigidity or resistance or rejection. And so she learns early on, whether she likes this or not, on an unconscious level, on a conscious level, she's taking it for whatever it is, because this is how she learns to get attention and love and all of these things. but she isn't, but she's fucking miserable.
Yeah.
Like you said, right? And so I think that the early development of not being given an opportunity to really explore who she is outside of this starts to breed that piece. And although we can't diagnose things that early, and it's not even about a diagnosis, it's just about seeing the trajectory of things, of how it looks like the father really worships her, but no, it's all very much conditioned on his needs, and he's a stage dad, mm-hmm. right? And so we've seen this with other kids as celebrity and what it can do to them. And sometimes we forget to think, like, because she's such a little shit, mm-hmm. that I'm not justifying how she treats Blanche and all of these things, but she was kind of set up for failure from the beginning through this because she had a talent and a look.
Yeah, and that's where she got that validation, the narcissistic extension validation is so often, like Kathy said, conditional. And it's usually in one area of your personality. So for her, it was, I'm going to get value by being cute and performing it, you know, and getting applause and attention. And so that's the way I'm going to get my needs met. And then, as we know, as we age and grow up, we have to develop other parts of ourselves. We don't get mm-hmm. to just be this like one trick pony like that and get validation from the world. Like you said, like it's like from this one supply when we're kids, but then you grow up and you realize not everyone's going to give you that narcissistic supply
or cares that much about whatever.
They don't even know what you're doing.
Yeah, that's right. Like that scene, remember that scene where she walks into the cleaners or whatever and she's like, I was baby J, and he's like, and she,
nobody knows who she is throughout this whole movie. She's constantly saying that.
And yeah, she walks out of there. The guy goes, who the hell is baby Jane? Whatever. You know, it's just
like other guys just shrug. Like, I don't know.
It makes me think of Napoleon Dynamite with Uncle Rico when he's still back in 82 and he's dreaming about being a football star. And everybody's like, get over it.
Get
45.
Yeah. It's really hard to let go of that. And many therapists have sat in rooms with people dealing with their narcissistic injuries, and many times it's because, you know, they're 40, 45, 50 and the dream never happened. You know, they didn't become the rock star, they didn't become the famous actor, they didn't do the special magical thing that whoever set them up for that thought they were going to be, and it all kind of crumbles. And in this movie, it's a representation of that. Her, whatever she held on to as a person until this age, it crumbles apart, and her whole sense of reality, delusions, hallucinate, whatever.
She never develops beyond. That's a great example of arrested development, right? Mm-hmm. Like she's childlike through this whole thing.
Totally. And her dysphoria mm-hmm. about what she looks like. There's this one scene when she looks in the mirror and she's singing the song, the song. And I won't give it away because I know it's horror fact.
It's the anthem.
But that's a baby fact with Kath.
I'm like, oh God, can we mute this? She's doing it again.
I know. So she goes, she's, you know, this older woman, and she goes to looking in the mirror, and she's like in her little dress with her little pigtails, and she looks just horrifying, really ridiculous. And she's singing the song, and she just devolves into tears and starts to freak out because for a moment she sees her true self and the dysphoria that she's having about, like, and there's another part in the movie where she talks about, like, where she's sort of saying, oh, no, it's close to that. You always want to talk about the bad things. I only want to talk about the good things. Like, of course, she just wants to live in this delusion that she's back being 10 years old and really famous.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mentioned something here that the article talked about. Let me just reference the article too. This is just, it's called Narcissistic Personality Disorder in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, Discussions on Mental Illness and Its Portrayal in Film by Alyssa Miller from 2018. Freud is reference in here appropriately. One of the things about her life was that she was never really forced to leave her social condition. She essentially, like what you're saying, Shannon, is there's so many delusions and dysphoria because she allowed herself to, once this career trajectory ended because she started to age out, she clearly still developed a world that she could live in that,
yeah.
Right? And so as we see the narcissism develop in folks, we know that with narcissism, much of the time it is in conjunction with paranoid ideation, because a lot of these folks, being that they don't have the ability to see like the integrated whole in others and see them as other people outside of themselves, or just kind of extensions of these of the narcissist, that they begin to feel paranoid because they know what they're capable of. They believe that some of these things might be done to them. And so Freud, in this context, obviously he's not talking about Baby Jane because he was not around for this movie, but he's talking about megalomania, which is a person really who's obsessed with their own power. And his quote is, "We can detect an element of megalomania in most other forms of paranoid disorders. We are justified in assuming that this megalomania is essentially of an infantile nature, and that, as development proceeds, it is sacrificed to social conditions." So, in other words, what I was saying earlier, where she had created this her own Neverland, in a sense that she could remain young, and it was very controlled, and she even had control over her sister, and even felt a sense of importance by Blanche being at her mercy. She really created her version of reality. So if she were to go out into the world and be forced into social conditions, it was like she was on another planet. And that's where we really start to see it play out even more, because the world's looking at her going, "The fuck is this?"
Well, right? Yeah, for sure. And I would add that she was afforded certain successes in her family, you know, her sister's wealth and all of this, to be able to do that. And so I think that's where it comes in. We always talk about a set of circumstances that has to like jive in order to have these kind of violent people. And I think one of the things that happened is, if, you know, if her sister hadn't been successful, or if something had happened with the money or whatever, she would have been forced to like go out and get a job. And it would be, she might have just been violent earlier. I don't know. Like, right. Who knows? Or she might have, you know, gotten married and then there's a domestic situation there, or what have you. We're just not sure. Maybe she would have had kids and abused them. We just don't know where right. That would have gone. But yep. There, because of their family's success, you know, she was afforded that option to be in seclusion like she was. And then it just kind of devolved from there. But I think that's also why we would probably want to mention a little bit of the sister's situation, because I think the sister added to it in the sense that from a very early age, her sister was told, even though, you know, your dad and your sister and all that are mean to you and talk down to you and be less than, in the movie it states, like, "I was told to be nicer to them than anyone because they needed it more, because they were so mad and mean and rageful and all of this. They were mean to me, so I'm supposed to be nicer to them," mm-hmm. was the message she got from her mother and her family. And so that sort of set up this dynamic where the sister she even signs a contract that says, "If I do a movie, then my sister has to get a movie that year as well. And every year I do a movie, she has to do a movie," and shared all the money, lived with her, you know, really placated and tried to play this second daddy role with her sister to try to take, infantilizing her even further.
Oh God.
So that dynamic is infantilizing for this narcissist, and also created that. And I'm not saying she's to blame. It's just, there's all these certain circumstances that created this, so to speak, monster.
Yeah, for sure. I would agree with that. And I think it all stems from how it just all started off wrong.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this little kid had the fucking doll. The Baby Jane doll.
Yeah, the first couple of scenes you see that her dad creates the Baby Jane doll and then like sells it at her shows. It's all very circus.
And then she, you know, has conversations with it later in the movie. But living in LA, and you and I both in our own time being exposed to Hollywood different ways, we've seen what can happen to kids this young who go into the industry. And though it's not always that way, if you have healthy parents, we've seen some kids go through that and develop into pretty successful actors in adulthood and are, you know, at least seemingly healthy. We don't know them personally, but oftentimes, especially before there were all these regulations that there are now, you know, and look at all the cases that we've seen that you and I have talked about in the show, Britney Spears being one of them, you know, where Lindsay Lohan is another one. Macaulay Culkin is another one where these kids were just, their talent was their blessing and their curse. And they really, you know, when we think about the development of this stuff being nature or nurture, so much of this was situational for them. And then when we look at these dynamics of the way the different roles play out in siblings, when there is a narcissistic parent, you have the golden child and you have the, you know, all these things. We clearly see that, I think, played out. They just both ended up pretty sick because of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just want to switch briefly before we get our answers to the facts. I want to switch basically to one other way, and then Kathy can add whatever you have left to say about this. But I want to make sure that you know that another way we know, another way we talk about narcissism and the psychopathy that ends up playing out, because she does become violent. She becomes very abusive. She's abusing alcohol every day, all day. This is Baby Jane I'm talking about. And another way we see her narcissism acting out. Now, is it a byproduct of her substance abuse? Not sure. Is it a byproduct of her childhood? Not sure. Like, it's a combination of all of those things. But we know that she's being narcissistically abused. In other words, Blanche is being narcissistically and physically and violently abused by Baby Jane, because we see certain things, right? We see her isolate the victim. We see her taking away control of her food, who she sees, who she calls. Slowly throughout the movie, we see her rip out the phone, lock her away, not feed her, send everybody away that comes to see her. We also see a lot of gaslighting. I didn't say that. That's not what happened. Just like this complete fabrication of reality, gaslighting her, and ultimately kills her pet. You know, it's very, it's later movies in the 80s and 90s, Fatal Attraction, Misery, all these different movies are obviously playing by this formula, playing by this script of just like this movie. So that's another way we sort of see who she is by the way she treats her sister. And so I just, you know, those, of course, those qualities we've mentioned many times, but that happens in this movie too.
No, and I think you're right. I think it really was a template for a lot of these movies that we have, these isolation horrors and stuff that we've seen later on. We also know that she befriends this flipping idiot, Edwin, right? And Edwin is, they're kind of extensions of each other, because although he seemingly seems, you know, fairly innocuous and whatever, he's kind of getting his own benefit from befriending her as well.
Of course.
But one thing that he does really well for her is he enables all of this, you know, he's encouraging her to get back into stardom and like, oh, you really think I could have this, you know, this life again kind of thing. And he's doing it all for his own benefit
you know,
as well.
And it's so funny because we see that so much with performers and in Hollywood is the yes man, right? Or this, I can't think of the word, but we see this all the time where people are sucking up to you to get money or fame or for you to give them a job. Like he has this delusion. He just wants to make a living. Like he's just trying to pay his rent. He lives with his mother. You know, like
he's a character.
Yeah, he's great. It was that role was supposed to be played by somebody else. Some studio execs, you know, person. And luckily they got Victor Buono, who's amazing.
And Betty Davis didn't want him at first.
Yeah.
She was like, absolutely not. And when they started working together, then she was like, okay, the buy-in was there.
But he was great.
He was great.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's a complete idiot in this and plays kind of the dumb fool, but he knows what he's doing. And for a narcissist, the most perfect person to have in their, you know, arena is an enabler and a yes man. And that's exactly what he was.
That's what they got. They played up. So just psychologically, from our perspective, there's just like all the characters. It's very much a case study type of movie.
Totally. And I think, you know, this, the last thing I'll say speaks to what you already said about her behavior towards Blanche, but clearly there's a huge lack of empathy. You know, what, mm-hmm. what she ends up doing to her sister. It's like, wow.
Well, and just so everyone knows, it's a psychological movie and it's a horrifying movie, but it's also a heightened kind of melodrama, and there's a lot of camp, and there's quite a bit of, when it comes to this guy, Victor, Eddie, he's funny. It's, there is humor in this.
Oh yeah.
And in the scenes with him and Betty, I was laughing, and maybe that's why Betty Davis didn't want him, because she was all in her serious headspace, this I'm a psycho, and he was definitely like the comedy relief. So there's comedy in this, there's thriller, there's horror, there's really disturbing things that happen. But I think it's got a little bit of it all.
It does. Honestly. And I think if you can allow yourself some of the gallows humor,
yep.
some of these scenes, especially, and I'm not giving it, I won't give anything away, but the very last scene on the beach is just like, you're so astounded by what's going on. I was laughing so hard because it's so fucking disturbing.
It is disturbing. And I mean, some people might laugh at it because it's so melodramatic.
It is that too.
So the style is very different than what we're used to watching, but
for sure,
you know, but, whatever.
But you know what? I think it really set the, it set the stage for a lot of films that came after. So
you bet it sure did. So let's get some answers to our
baby facts with her. It's so stupid. Okay, number one, a known rivalry between Joan Crawford and Betty Davis created tension on the set. Davis had this installed on the set to anger Joan Crawford, who was on the board of this item's competitor.
Like a Pepsi machine or something?
So Betty Davis installed a Coca-Cola machine because Joan Crawford was on the board for Pepsi and her husband, who had passed, was once the CEO.
You know why I guess that is because in the movie, when Joan tries to get the executive to make this.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's all over. She inserts it everywhere.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny. Number two, what song does Baby Jane sing in the opening act?
I wrote a letter to my daddy.
I've written a letter to daddy.
Oh, and that is Kathy.
Oh my God. And then when she sings it as an adult, you're like, please stop. I'll give you anything to stop.
So perfect.
I'll give you 3 strawberry ice cream cones.
It's so perfect.
She's great. Sorry, real quickly, side note. It also reminds me of a David Lynch a little bit too, and what he did in like Eraserhead. That really just bizarre, kind of like, what is going on right now?
The black and white lends it to that.
And the dream lady with the weird face. Okay.
Yeah.
Number three, according to Betty Davis in her book, This and That, the original film was going to be shot in color. Davis opposed this for what reason?
I just thought maybe because in black and white, she'd look older.
She said it would just make a sad story pretty.
Oh, yeah.
And I have one more fact after I read these last two answers, which I will
just
leave you
so
on.
Many things
I do.
To
it's
add.
So, this, there's so much around this, so fascinating. How many films did Joan Crawford appear in throughout her career?
I don't really know. I was going to say like 25.
Over 80.
Wow.
Yeah. And actually, Davis was upwards of 100.
Yeah. They churned them out then.
They did.
Yeah.
Because both of them ended up doing a lot of like B horror and stuff.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And number five, what was Betty Davis an advocate for?
I don't know.
Gender equality and equal pay in the industry. That was a big thing for her. So the last thing I'll say, and this is just kind of funny, is Davis's daughter, I guess, showed up on the set one day because I guess, you know, Betty Davis is one of the things this movie is known for, if you haven't seen it, is just this awful makeup. It's so gaudy. It's so awful. And the reason why Davis decided to do that is she's like, I wanted her to depict this, like a woman that gets up each day. She never washes her face. She just keeps reapplying on top of what was there.
That was obvious.
And so that's what she did in this method role. And I guess her daughter shows up to set one day and she goes, "Oh, mother, now you've gone too far." So I don't know. There's just a lot of really good trivia and stuff around this film.
Yeah, there's several books and series and there's all kinds of things. It's you could really go down a rabbit hole, which I started to do. And then I'm like, OK, I have other episodes to prepare for.
Yeah, for sure.
I am going to put those on hold and watch them some other time. And there's a couple books I would like to read about it, too. It's kind of fascinating. Mm-hmm. This has been an episode of Terror Talk. We very much appreciate you. My name is Shannon.
And I'm Kathy. Sleep safe, everyone.